in the teachings, which is the mind, that means your mind and my mind, the mind, is naturally radiant and pure. The mind is shining. It's because of visiting forces that we suffer. The mind is naturally radiant and pure. The mind is shining. It's because of visiting forces that we suffer. Now, the old-fashioned translation for those forces is defilement. It's clearly, you know, somewhat problematic as a word. I call my words these days. Because it can have a very judgmental tone, like, I am so defiled, you are so defiled. But the literal translation of that word from Pali or Sanskrit is torments of the mind. And that's something we can get behind, right? And we're not talking about something just arising, being met with balance. We're talking about taking something to heart or being lost in a certain state or quality or attitude. So what torments us when we take it in? Grief, hatred, fear, jealousy. We know that list, right? We can probably add some of our own unique expressions of that. The mind is naturally radiant and pure. The mind is shining. It's because of visiting forces that we suffer. So there are two parts of that that are really remarkable. One is these forces are just visiting. However strong, however intense, however commonly they come, you're still just visiting. And the other part is that I find remarkable is the Buddha doesn't say, despite the translation of the word defilement, you know, these forces don't make us bad, awful, terrible. They make us suffer. And of course, out of our own suffering, we all too often create suffering. But that's the valence. It's about suffering, not about bad, awful, terrible, evil. The mind is naturally radiant and pure. The mind is shining because of visiting forces that we suffer. I always thought that, you know, I saw myself right away kind of like sitting at home minding my own business and hearing a knock at the door. I open the door and there's greed or there's jealousy or something. And what do we tend to do? Sometimes we say, welcome home. It's all yours. Come in. I'll just leave now. Right? And very commonly we do the opposite. We're so freaked out. We're so upset. We're so ashamed. We're so frightened at the appearance of this force, this defilement, that we shut the door and we desperately try to pretend we never heard the knock. Only to find that that very force comes in through the window or down the chimney, somehow they make their appearance known. So one of the ways we talk about skill in meditation is, what do we do when we hear that knock? Can we open the door, see the jealousy, see the greed, see the fear, see the anger, and relate with awareness, with balance, with understanding and compassion? It's like, all right, I know you. You can go now, gently. Or some teachings would have you say, come in for a cup of tea, then you need to go. Right, there's strength, there's understanding. You don't live here. I live here. Awareness is here. But I'm going to be kind, you know. I'm going to let you come in and have a cup of tea. So I used that example of teaching in Barry at IMS once. Somebody in the room really didn't like it. And they said, how about tea to go? Okay, tea to go, you know. Whatever. because you have to feel empowered, you know, you're not just saying, come in, take over. But there's also, it's not like, oh my God, you know, spend all this money in therapy, you're still coming. You know, it's not that either. So that ability to recognize what's happening, not get lost in it, not just fight it and struggle, is called mindfulness. That's exactly what mindfulness is the ability to recognize anything with a certain kind of relationship to it. So that is the tremendous skill of mindfulness that we develop. When we're working also with cultivating loving kindness, with doing those particular techniques that are especially designed to cultivate the Brahmaviharas, we're also working with recognizing more and more who this is, what our options are, feeling at home with, say, love, knowing the strength of love, that we can maybe offer a cup of tea without saying, well, bed folds out, you know, couch folds out, I'll just move there, and you take over, right? Another way of seeing that, I sometimes tell the story about my friend Sherry taking me in Wisconsin to a prison to teach, and the story has nothing to do with the fact we're in prison, but that's where we were. And Sherry did this exercise. She asked three people to leave the room, and given that it was a prison, the staff person had to go as well, so four people left the room. And Sherry said to the rest of us in the room, now I want you to take anything you see, any kind of material object, and bring it into the center of the room and create some kind of structure from it. So there wasn't that much in the room. You know, there were some chairs, and I piled up a bunch of chairs, and there were two flags, and I put the flags in a certain angle. And we had taken off our shoes, so a bunch of shoes, and then I think there was one plant there. And then Sherry said to us, and I want you just to sit silently and look at this mound of stuff and think about what you see when you look at it. So I, clearly because of the flags, you know, thought that's a monument. That's the monument. And it evoked certain feelings in me. You know, triumph, valor, tragedy, victory. And then Sherry asked for the people who left the room to one by one come in and say out loud what they were seeing. So the first guy came back into the room and he looked at it. He said, that's a monument. And I thought, what a brilliant person. Of course, it's a monument. And, you know, needless to say, everybody came in and said something very, very different. Somebody who happens to have been a staff person came in and said, I see chaos. I just see chaos. Right? And it was so interesting, because everybody had a different interpretation of what they were saying. And Sherry, of course, was using this exercise to try to point to the nature of mindfulness. We look at something, we hear something, someone says something to us, and we have a direct experience. And then on top of that, we have a story that we tell. Now the purpose of mindfulness, despite the way a lot of people express it, is not to get rid of the story. That's what our minds do. They weave a narrative. They interpret. That's good often. Some of the stories we tell are beautiful. They bring us together. They excite our sense of aspiration, possibility. There's some beautiful ways of telling the story, and there's some stories that are more truthful than others. Some are like wild distortions, right? Really just based on the past, or what we've been told to believe. about ourselves or someone else. Other stories have more resonance with the way things actually are. And mindfulness doesn't destroy the story making or the narrative capacity of the mind. It shows us there's a gap. We have an experience, there's a gap, the story starts coming. And so we can see a story as a story, and we have a choice. Is this the same old story? You know the one I often tell about, this is my book, Faith, about this friend renting a house for several of us to do a retreat in, and when I went into the room, the bedroom that had been set aside for me, I saw someone had left a cartoon on the desk from the Peanuts comic strip, and in the first frame of the cartoon, Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown, and she says, oh, you know, Charlie Brown, what your problem is, the problem with you is that you're you. And in the second frame, where Charlie Brown says, well, what in the world can I do about that? And then in the third and final frame, Lucy being Lucy says, I don't pretend to be able to give advice, I merely point out the problem. So somehow whenever I was doing walking meditation by that desk, my eye would fall right on that line. The problem with you is that you're you. That's the story, right? If you really knew who you were, it would be really sad news. And in the light of mindfulness, one of the things that seeing the cartoon was very useful for was there's a certain technique of mindfulness called mental noting. Some of you are probably quite familiar with it, where, say, with the breath, you're not just feeling the breath, but you're making a mental note, in, out, in, out. Something strongly comes up, a wave of a certain kind of emotion. You make a mental note, joy, joy, or anger, anger, whatever. So I felt like seeing the cartoon gave me a new mental note, which was kind of easy. One of my favorite form of that was chill out. You know, something really great would happen for me. My first thought would be, it's never going to happen again. I said, I'm asleep. Right? Because that has all that embodiment of what I was talking about earlier. Tenderness, compassion, space, non-identification. I'm not Lucy. That's all. Is Lucy. So that's what mindfulness allows for us, is to see this is the direct experience, this is story, do I want to go with it? Maybe it's an old, damaging Lucy story. I've seen it before. I know what it does. I can let it go. Or maybe I do want to nurture it and carry along with it. So mindfulness gives us that option because we see the difference. And if we are specifically cultivating qualities like love and kindness or the other brahmaviharas, what happens is that our default story changes. That kind of immediate, extremely repetitive, automatic story shifts. So if it's been Lucy, even for a very long time, and we do practice like loving kindness meditation, instead of it being Lucy, it will be a story about caring. Instead of, if a lot of what we do, what we say, come from a place of fear, and we do practice like loving kindness, we will find that we are coming from a place of connection. It's a shift. It's not a determination. You know, it's not a strain. It's not a persona that we put on, like, oh man, you know, here I am, I'm talking to this person, I can't stand it, but I, you know, spent 2 days this loving kindness workshop. A lot of fire, even worse. You know, I've written a book on the very topic. A better act life, or, you know. It's not like that. It's like something shifts that kind of rush, you know, for Lucy starts to change. change, the proportion changes. Like, maybe Lucy still comes, and we have mindfulness to deal with that, for sure. But other stories start coming. You know, you're talking to somebody, and you're not that intrigued, and you might realize, no, it's not going to cost me anything to really be here. Maybe I have no one else to talk to. Right? I could be here. Or whatever it might be. And it just starts to flow differently as we do this practice. Some practices of mindfulness practice are more about meeting whatever happens in our experience with a new way of relating. Loving kindness practice is more about experimenting in terms of style, and they certainly support one another. And what I mean by experimenting is actually stretching. You know, it's being willing to look from a different angle. Experimenting, say, with paying attention to someone we normally ignore. And that is, you know, a common example of that would be someone who plays some role in our life. I long ago wrote about this friend of mine doing a retreat. I teach an intensive 7-day retreat every winter in Massachusetts, doing loving kindness practice. And one of the phases of that is offering loving kindness to a mutual person. So, and then we go on from there. So, this friend of mine sat that retreat, and then I didn't see her again for many months when I saw her on this other retreat. And she came up to me, this other retreat, all beaming, shiny, and she said, "I've fallen in love with my dry cleaner." I said, "Really? That's so interesting." Clearly thinking she was dating him, and she said, no. Not romantically, but he was my mutual person back in that that we taught. And now every day when I meditate, I hold him in my heart and I wish him well. And now I go into the store and it's like, "How are you doing? How are things?" She said, "I really care about him." And, you know, so then I wrote this article about loving kindness and I used her story and I ran into her, you know, quite a bit later, and I said, "How's your dry cleaning?" And she said, "You know, I still go into the store, and I still have this kind of feeling for him." She said, "I've moved on to the UPS person." I talked with her recently, she's a rabbi. I talked with her recently, and I thought, you know, she was sitting next to me, and I thought, "Can I tell that story?" About her, and then to my delight, she told the story. And she said, you know, and she said it now, you know, she said, "I feel," she's still with the dry cleaner as well as you feel. She still like cares about him, and she's talking about the consequence of the practice. She said, you know, this new kind of like eco-friendly, politically correct dry cleaner opens up, but I can't leave. Loyalty, and now there's like a new generation working in the store, and it's just like, it was really sweet to hear that it's still happening. So there are a few points from that. One is, in doing a practice like loving kindness practice, we tend to see the changes most emphatically in our lives, not necessarily when we're formally sitting. And that's important to note. Really, with any practice, that is often the flow. And not only that, it often starts with other people seeing the change in us before we see it ourselves. I've had many people come to me and say, "You know, I was going to stop meditating, and then my kids came to me and said, 'Please don't stop.' You're much better than it used to be." So sometimes other people see it before we do. Then we see it, but the place we tend to see it is in our lives. And then perhaps we see it when we're, you know, sitting half an hour a day or whatever it is. But in a way, I mean, it takes huge patience to continue the practice if you don't have some great, you know, rainbow, beautiful, you know, extraordinary experience when you're sinning. But in the end, it's the least important place, right? It's much more important in our lives than it is in that formal session. So that's an important takeaway from that. It also means that when you do the practice, it doesn't help to be constantly evaluating it at the same time. I have this, you know, I've got love, I'm good, you know. But to kind of give it some time, say, okay, I'm just going to make this experiment. I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to look to see if it's effective, because you want to do that, right? But we recognize to look in our lives rather than in that formal session. So it's the stretch, it's the intentionality. Couldn't care less about my dry cleaner, but I'm going to see what happens when I open my heart and wish him love. That's different than determining I'm going to love my dry cleaner completely by the end of the week, right? It's an experiment. We're going to see what happens as we do this. And we'll, of course, talk much more about this throughout these days. So, the two common ways of training in this practice in terms of form, one is walking, one is sitting. But, of course, this is something you can do however, you know, whatever activity you're engaged in. The way we do the practice commonly is through the silent repetition of certain phrases. Not to demand a certain feeling or try to manufacture something, but as a way to guide our attention. To include rather than exclude, to pay attention rather than ignore, to consider rather than judge right away. That will help you in your work. And so we use the phrases as a way to express what we're really experimenting with, inclusion, opening, considering, recognizing. We use the phrases to play. And so, you know, the other day of the week I was in an airport for a lot of hours. And it was a whole drama, you know, because of some rain and some lightning, which had already passed. Anyway, I'm sure I'll tell that story too. There was plenty of opportunity to do some loving kindness practices. We play. You know, I thought, okay, I'm standing here, I was in the airport, it was hard to describe, in the airport for 5 hours at night, and then they canceled the flight at 11 o'clock at night, I was in the airport 4 hours the next day. So for the first time in my life, I was late to a program to retrieve this was to teach, so it was a lot of opportunity for all kinds of things. You know, so I thought, okay, I'm online here for the second hour tonight, trying to get a different flight, just intuitively feeling, it was going to be necessary, and it wasn't working, and everything was a mess. I thought, I can either be totally miserable, or I can start offering loving kindness to this poor Harry guy who was probably the 10,000th person who was trying to get to Chicago. And so it's a form of play. It's not like saying I'm, you know, dreadful and practicing meditation for 4 years, I want myself upset. But I thought, let's see what happens when I often loving kindness. It wasn't easy. when I finally got up, you know, 4 hours later to the front of the line, I was just on holds for hours and hours and hours with United Airlines. And so I finally got to the front of the line and I said, I have to get to Chicago tomorrow. And he said, do you? Okay. Well, I'll tell you that story. That's probably. You know, so we play, we experiment, and we utilize the phrases for that experiment. So the phrases being words, clearly, it's not easy. They're imperfect. I usually suggest to people you choose good enough phrases. It may not be perfect, doesn't matter, they're the conduit for that stretching, for paying attention, for the heart space that we're looking at. So we start actually with doing some walking meditation, and if you have a physical limitation on walking, you don't have to do walking. There's certain principles involved. Eyes open, more engaged, because, you know, we see things around us. It's the silent repetition of certain phrases. I always try to emphasize that. Because once I didn't, I guess, emphasize it enough. In Berkeley, where we went and did our walking on the streets. And someone came back and said, there was a group of people on the street corner, and I finally mustered up all my courage, and I went up to them and said, maybe not me. And I thought, at least it's Berkeley. So, silent repetition of certain phrases. There are lots and lots of ways of doing this. So I'm going to suggest one way as a possibility. We'll go out and do it, and then we're going to sit and have the first of our loving kindness sittings. So the phrases, whether sitting or walking, need to be pretty general, because you don't want to be constantly thinking and trying to think of new phrases for different recipients. That would just be too exhausting, and it would make us kind of agitated anyway. That's why I say good enough phrases. They need to be very general, because it's something you're offering to yourself and to others. A common way of phrasing is beginning with oneself, something like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. Others, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. Sometimes people have some difficulty with that construct, may I, may you, it sounds too much like pleading or begging. And it's not meant to be that at all, as my friend Sylvia says, it's like handing someone a birthday card. And you say, may you have a happy birthday. May you have a great new year. So it's got a little verb to it. In that way, the feeling tone is one of blessing. It's gift giving. We're giving someone a gift. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. We're giving ourselves a gift. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. Something like that. So in sitting, as you know, as you back, it's usually three or four phrases. In walking, sometimes it's fewer, but that's up to you. You know, you can experiment with that. And the way I like to do walking meditation, and you also walk at a totally normal pace. If somebody was looking at you from a car, you look normal. Very normal to you. What I like to do is walk along using phrases toward myself, for myself. So it's like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. May I be happy, may I be peaceful. And then if someone comes strongly into my consciousness, I hear a bird, I hear a dog, I see a person coming by, I see a bug, I just briefly include them, and then I go back to the phrases for myself. And there's a lot of life out there, you know, you can get really jumbled. Go be happy, be happy, be happy, which is why I like to have the phrases for myself as a baseline. Our awareness is very light. You don't want to kind of hunker down, try to not notice anything going on around you. It's just very light attention, resting on the phrases as we're aware of everything. It gives us a touchstone as we go along. As with any practice, the absolute essence of it is going to be the ability to begin again, and begin again, and begin again. Because especially eyes open, if you go outside, which you do, although you don't have to, you know, you can walk in the room behind, downstairs, you know, really whatever's appropriate for you. You want to have just this as you're aware of everything else, right? So it's an experiment, and you'll get distracted. If you're outside and you see like a little patch of flowers, there's a moment of appreciating them, which is so commonly followed by, I'm gonna grow those flowers. I don't have enough sunlight in my yard. I don't have really a yard. It's a scrappy thing. I've got to move. I'm not going to have to lose Seattle. Where should I move to? Right? That's what we commonly do. And then we realize that we have to begin again. May I be happy? May I be peaceful? Okay? So, we're going to take about 35 minutes. Please maintain silence in this period. This is really a practice period, so even if you end up, I mean, if you go get a cup of coffee, you don't have to be silent as you order it. But you can keep the phrases going as you drink it. And really try to use this as a time for practice, and we'll come back at 11:30.